The Gone Cold podcast may contain violent or graphic subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
On February 21st, 1971, the newspaper, the Odessa American, published an article describing mythology regarding the moon, how Earth's celestial satellite was thought by the ancient people to be a goddess, and that the goddess might inflict madness upon those she deemed to have done her wrong. For a significant portion of human existence, too, scholars and philosophers correlated certain moon phases with insanity and violence. The words lunatic and the term moonstruck are both derived from the moon, of course, though the effect of the lunar stages on the behavior of human beings is far from fact. The article, nevertheless, quotes a municipal court judge who told the paper that every time there's a full moon, his court experiences a drastic increase in people charged in a crime, and the crimes he refers to are violent in nature, such as fighting and domestic violence, for example. A behaviorist with the Texas Department of Corrections in Huntsville offers in the article his take on why, noting that crimes like burglary are best performed with the least amount of light, but goes on to say, quote, "When you have crimes against persons during a full moon, it's because more people are out and available because of the light situation." Anyway, the larger point of the article was, perhaps, to make sense of the senseless murders of five area women, slayings that occurred within close proximity to a full moon, and were so brutal and mysterious that the citizens of Odessa and the surrounding areas were in a constant state of fear. The notion that the perpetrator or perpetrators acting out as a result of the full moons, like the Odessa American article suggests, is relatively absurd, of course, but the slayings the article speaks of should be further explored. While a couple of the murders were eventually solved, one remains cold, and two were cleared as the result of what a court would later determine to be coerced confessions. Odessa, Texas, is the county seat of Ector County. When mentioned, the city is most often lumped with neighboring Midland, which was once a problem for residents of both cities, and though friendly rivalry still exists, both Midland and Odessa now embrace it. Odessa and Midland are just two cities included in a vast area of West Texas known as the Permian Basin, named so due to the 86,000 square mile of rock, a thick deposit of sedimentary rock from the Permian geological period. The area, of course, is rich in oil and gas. 24-year-old Linda Lee Cougat was fiercely independent, but was also considered a dependable and hard-working woman. On Saturday, October 19, 1968, at 9 p.m., Linda left her 6-year-old son with a close friend, Don, and headed to the day and night laundromat in Odessa, Texas, to dry the clothes she'd washed at home. Presumably, she dropped her laundry in the dryer, and instead of waiting at the laundromat, decided to stop in at her place of employment, a place called the Bowler Bar, as she was seen there that night by several co-workers with another woman. Before that, at about 8 p.m., Linda was seen at a drive-in by two employees, again with a woman. The employees didn't know the identity of the woman with Linda, but described her as early 20s, dark hair, and driving a small brown or rust-colored foreign car. The two women placed an order there, but drove away before employees brought it out to the car. The identity of the woman she was seen with has never been discovered. A patrol officer later came forward saying he'd noticed a woman inside the laundromat facility fitting Linda's description and a car matching the description of her vehicle in the parking lot. Linda's friend Dawn began searching for her after she didn't come home that night, but had to return to the house so the child could sleep. At approximately 9:30 a.m. on the following day, Sunday, October 20th, the day and night laundromat owner arrived at his facility and noticed Linda's vehicle parked in a way in which he described as irregular. The keys were still in the ignition, and he moved to the car and went inside where he found Linda's laundry, along with Dawn's slacks on an ironing board, half pressed. The owner found no signs that a struggle had occurred there. Dawn was searching for Linda again that day, and after speaking with the laundromat's owner and finding no other signs of Linda, he called the Odessa police to tell them that Linda was missing. After searching more, and after Linda's friend and co-worker came to see Dawn, the two visited the police station to file a report at around midnight, now Monday, October 21st, 1968. Since Linda Cougat was known to drop out of sight from time to time, Odessa police at first didn't meet her disappearance with haste, and clues as to Linda's whereabouts were scant. Tips police soon began receiving, too, led nowhere, though the nature of them was most often bizarre. On Wednesday, October 23rd, 1968, the bar where Linda worked got a strange phone call. An employee of the bar picked up a ringing telephone to hear the screams of a woman. The employee quickly asked if the caller was Linda and quoted the caller as saying, "Yes, God, this is Linda. Oh my God, help me." After more blood-curdling screams, the caller hung up. Odessa police didn't exactly know what to do with the call and made no determination, at least publicly, on whether the call was legitimate or simply a prank. In the weeks to come, tips coming into the police station would lead investigators across Texas and into New Mexico, and even to California, where a caller said Linda was in Oildale. Another tip called into the police claimed that Linda could be found in a caliche pit near Pinwell, a town about 10 miles away from Odessa's center. But Linda's body wasn't there. Nor could her body be located at the intersection of Moss Avenue and 42nd Street in West Odessa, the spot another anonymous caller phoned in. Odessa police had a tough time. No one could imagine anyone wanting to hurt Linda, and though friends of hers told police that the bar she worked for was frequented by a lot of creeps, solid leads just weren't coming in. The mystery of Linda Lee Cougat's whereabouts came to an end on Sunday, December 15th, 1968, when a quail hunter discovered the decomposed remains of a woman wearing black Bermuda shorts and a blue checkered blouse near Farm to Market Road 1936 and State Highway 158 in Northwest Ector County. Linda's remains, far from where any of the tips had placed her. The discovery was quite grisly. Linda was lying face up beneath a dead mesquite tree. Her hands were bound behind her back by two nylon stockings, one binding her wrists and another binding her upper arms. She was 85 feet from Farm to Market Road 1936. Another stocking was knotted twice around her neck. Though her shorts were on her body, her panties had been removed and were left at the scene, providing evidence that she'd been redressed. Linda was positively ID'd at around 2 p.m. the following day using dental records. The bridge that was imperative in the identification was found lodged deeply down her throat. Because Linda was so badly decomposed and mummified, The medical examiner was unable to tell if she had been sexually assaulted. The medical examiner determined her death to have been caused by strangulation and occurring around the same time she disappeared. Linda's black handbag was found the day of the autopsy, about 1/3 of a mile south of where she was found, on the other side of FM 1936, near a cattle guard. Linda's purse contained 3 address books, some spare change, and a marriage license, presumably that she'd been carrying around since October 10th, 9 days before she went missing, since she'd filed for divorce from her husband that day. Searching the area near where the purse was discovered, officers found a rent receipt dated October 17th, a cigarette lighter, and various cosmetics. 2 days after Linda's body was discovered, her stepfather revealed to the press several incomplete notes his stepdaughter had written telling them she was in fear for her life before she vanished. Linda had written on one, "I'm okay so far, but I need help." Police exhausted the possible leads that the address books within the purse provided. They administered a polygraph test to her friend Dawn and cleared him. They tracked down the movements of an unnamed suspect for almost a month, but declined to question him after learning of an alibi he supposedly had for the night Linda disappeared. And they ultimately came up empty-handed. Police later attempted to connect 25-year-old Nathan Curry to Linda's slaying. Curry bludgeoned and stabbed a 53-year-old woman to death when he was only 15 years old in Cisco, Texas. But the connection they sought to make had to do with an abduction robbery and an abduction rape, both at laundromats, the last place Linda Cougat was known to be, and both crimes Curry perpetrated in February of 1969 in Amarillo. But when Cisco police went to question Curry in 1971 about several other murders in Dallas and the surrounding area, he walked out his back door and shot himself in the head. No matter, the police ultimately got what they wanted, a confession for Linda's murder from a man named Johnny Meadows when he was picked up for another murder. Meadows later recanted, and later still, a court found that confession to have been coerced. The Odessa police, however, declined to open her case back up for investigation after the fact, and it remains cleared. Anyway, long before Meadows' confession for Linda's murder, good or not, another young woman was found slain, the circumstances of which were entirely different, but just as savage and senseless, and true fear and panic that a killer was among them hit the residents of Odessa hard. Are you prepared for the unthinkable? Insurance companies these days often refuse coverage for some of the unexpected costs of medical emergencies, leaving you holding an outrageous bill that you probably weren't prepared for. There is a way, though, to safeguard your health and protect your finances from such an event with an AirMed Care Network membership. For as low as $65 per year, an AirMed Care Network membership can provide you or your family with emergency medical transport to the nearest appropriate hospital with no out-of-pocket expenses. Members never pay a dime to be transported by an AirMed Care Network provider. They are the largest group of emergent transport providers in the world, so join the 3 million AirMed Care Network members and secure your peace of mind today. I just got my plan the other day, and I can attest that the peace of mind is real. Right now, AirMed Care Network is offering Gone Cold listeners a $10 Visa gift card with a 1-year membership. Just visit airmedcarenetwork.com/Texas and use offer code Texas. Again, visit airmedcarenetwork.com/Texas and use offer code Texas and get a $10 Visa gift card when you sign up for a 1-year membership. In July of 1970, Over a year and a half since the bound and strangled body of Linda Cougat was discovered, anxiety over her murder had waned. Sadistic and shocking murders were a thing for bigger cities like Dallas and Houston again, and Odessa residents had relaxed back into their lives as a modest-sized sleepy city. One of those residents, Eula Mae Miller, was a 26-year-old go-go dancer at Odessa's Tempo Club, a mother of four, and lived on the ground floor of the Hilltop Apartments on the corner of Dixie Boulevard and 8th Street. She was known professionally as Kay Miller, and by all accounts, she was extremely popular in her circle of friends and with her clientele. Eula made a big impression on everyone she ever came into contact with, and loved being surrounded by people. At least one friend reported that her inclination to always have friends around was at least partially due to a separation with her husband, who retained custody of her children. Though most of her friends admitted to not knowing Eula well at all, she was wildly popular at the Tempo Club with guests and other dancers. On Sunday, July 12th, 1970, at about 4 p.m., an unidentified man left Eula's apartment after hanging out with her at an all-night supper club that evening and driving her back to her home. She was briefly seen after the man left doing laundry at the complex's facilities, and at 5 p.m. that day, she was seen paying rent at the complex's office. At 10 a.m. on Monday the 13th, the manager of the apartments was entering units to let exterminators in, but left Eula's apartment when she saw that she was asleep, or so she thought. A neighbor of Eula's spotted a man visiting her apartment at some point early that day, and a little later returning to the apartment with food from a local drive-in. A friend of Eula's reported that a slim, well-dressed man entered her apartment that Monday evening too, and the friend overheard a conversation taking place behind the closed door, but didn't report actually seeing Eula. And she likely couldn't have. Eula's upstairs neighbor had just returned from a trip at around 6 p.m. on Monday the 13th and says she began to notice a foul odor. On Thursday, July 16th, the odor had become too much for the woman to bear, and she called the assistant manager of the complex. The odor was more than apparent when the complex manager entered Eula's apartment, but she saw nothing in disarray, nothing to suggest a struggle had taken place. When she entered the bedroom, though, she discovered Eula's deceased nude body stretched across her bed. It was a gruesome sight for both the assistant manager and the detectives who soon arrived on the scene. The young woman's fully nude body lay on the bed. There were no sheets on it, and no blankets covering her. "There was an awful amount of blood, but most of it had soaked into the mattress," remarked Odessa Detective T.D. McQueen of the scene. She was stabbed a total of 7 times, 4 times in her chest, 2 times in her head just above her left eye, and 1 time in the right side of the neck. The knife wound in the neck punctured Eula's jugular vein and was determined later by the medical examiner to be what killed her. No murder weapon remained on the scene. Eula Mae Miller had not been sexually assaulted. Detectives, like the apartment manager, made note that Eula's apartment was orderly and there were no signs of a struggle. Nothing, too, had appeared to be taken, and they acted fast, tracking down and questioning around 100 people who either knew her closely or professionally. The man she was last seen with the prior Sunday afternoon was also the last known person to see her alive. He dropped Eula off at her apartment at around 4 p.m., and she'd been seen after that, and the results of his polygraph test showed that he was not involved in her murder, according to police. There are some bizarre details in the case, such as a note found written by the young woman that read, "Dawn, come on in. I'm in bed asleep and may not hear you." Another note was also found, this one from Don, informing Eula that he'd been by, but the door was locked and there were no responses to his knocks. Both notes were found inside the apartment, and though the lead seemed like a potential gold mine for investigators, Don was later tracked down in Fort Worth and fully cooperated. His story was deemed truthful. His accounts and alibis were checked out. A neighbor noticed Eula's door slightly ajar the same evening, and presumably the woman's killer slipped in when the door was unlocked, removing Eula's note to Don and discarding it on her floor. Don had slipped his reply note under the door. It is possible the killer was inside when Don came knocking. Eula Miller's billfold was found in a vacant house in Kermit, Texas, a few days after her body was discovered. But since she'd recently gotten a duplicate driver's license, and a friend of hers was known to have stayed in that house some months before, investigators were unsure how long the wallet had been there, and they didn't know if the fact that it was there had any connection to her death at all. Police ran down all the leads they could. Eula Miller's file, in fact, had grown to be Odessa's largest police file by October of that year. But they got absolutely no results to show for that. Years later, in 1974, Tommy Ray Neeland, who resided in nearby Kermit at the time of Eula Mae Miller's slaying, was arrested after a badly botched kidnapping attempt in Fort Worth, and subsequently confessed to three other unspeakably horrific murders. Neeland, a carpet layer and Sunday school teacher while in Kermit, couldn't be connected with Eula's killing, which remains unsolved to this day. But the brutal and depraved acts that he is known to have committed mirror the grotesque and savage overkill seen in the taking of Eula's life, one of which was the next crime to shake the residents of Odessa and the rest of the Permian Basin, the murder of 27-year-old Kermit housewife and mother of two, Nancy Seiler Mitchell, who was missing from September 16, 1970, just 2 months after Eula Miller's body was found, until June 5, 1971, when her skeletal remains were found on an oil lease. Until Neeland's capture in 1974, Nancy's loved ones were forced to live with the uncertainty of what happened to her. What he confessed to, though, likely offered them no relief. Neeland gave a written statement confessing to suffocating Nancy Mitchell with a plastic bag, shooting air into her right arm with a hypodermic needle, and stabbing and slashing the mother. He couldn't even tell investigators which of those acts killed Nancy Mitchell. Before her remains were discovered on the oil lease off Highway 302 in Kermit, though, while Nancy was still considered a missing person, another woman disappeared from Odessa. On Saturday, January 9, 1971, the mother of a one-year-old girl and a four-year-old boy and wife of an Odessa police officer left her house at a little after 10 p.m. Ruth Maynard had returned home from her job as a cashier at a local discount store shortly before that. Her husband Jack was on his way out to work night patrol. Ruth told her sister, who lived with the couple, that she needed to run to the grocery store, asking if she'd watch over the sleeping children while she was away. She left the home wearing a black pants suit, black shoes, and a short green coat. Ruth wouldn't be driving to the grocery store, however. She had plans to meet a coworker at the Stardust Club, a local bar. The woman who she was supposed to meet didn't show up, it is reported, and a witness placed Ruth at the Shadow Club, a couple blocks away from the Stardust, drinking a beer. This would be the last reported sighting of the 24-year-old petite blonde, alive at least. Ruth's car was found in the parking lot of the Shadow Club the next day. Police spent the next several weeks searching for the wife of their fellow officer. The entire department took the disappearance of the woman personally, as would be expected. On Monday, February 15, 1971, about 4 miles from where the body of Linda Lee Cougat had been found just over 2 years before, the body of Ruth Maynard was discovered in a pasture in northwest Odessa by ranchers on horseback. She was lying face up and only partially clothed, her pantsuit unzipped, torn, and pushed down about halfway down her hips. Her panties were intact. Her bra was under her head. A stocking knotted around her neck. A mesquite stick protruded out of the stocking knot and was used as a tourniquet to strangle the young woman. Another stocking was discovered on the ground just below her feet. It was knotted as well, and appeared to detectives to have been used to tie either her feet or hands, but had come loose at some point. Her body was reported by police to the Odessa American newspaper to have been especially well preserved, but they were uncertain if this was due to the weather or her body being stored somewhere else for a period of time. Ruth's husband Jack was so distraught by his wife's disappearance that he had put in his resignation shortly before her body was found. His last day on the job, in fact, was to be the day Ruth was discovered. Police searched for clues and for Ruth's black purse, but came up empty-handed. They had no evidence and no leads. They certainly held back more information, too, about the investigation into Ruth Maynard's murder, presumably because her husband was an officer. Investigators thought there was a link between the murder of Ruth Maynard and Linda Cougat, both in Odessa, and the disappearance of Nancy Mitchell in neighboring Kermit. Police Chief Jack Tomlin told reporters, "I don't think we're looking for three men." A confession was later made in Ruth Maynard's murder, but like the case of Linda Cougat, a court would later find the confession to have been coerced. And like Linda's murder, Odessa police have cleared Ruth's case from the books, even though the confession was ruled invalid. The disappearance of 28-year-old Oletta Fuller, mother of six, who went missing just before Ruth, added fuel to Odessa's already burning fears. She'd left her home to pick up beer for her husband, but never returned. Her 11-year-old daughter provided investigators with some clues, as she reported that her mother had met up with a guy named Don, who was in the vehicle when Oletta dropped off the young girl, telling her that she was never coming back. It was discovered 18 days later that Oletta had gone to her sister's in Irving and was working in Dallas. Regardless of the relief that followed that good news, after Ruth's murder, Odessa was in the state of full-out panic, and the murders weren't over yet. On Thursday, June 17, 1971, Gloria Sue Nix Green mysteriously vanished from O&L Oil Well Service Company on the outskirts of Odessa. Gloria was employed as a dispatcher at the business. Her shoes and purse sat under her desk, her vehicle still parked in the business's parking lot. Gloria was small, very small, just like every other woman who'd been slain or had gone missing in the recent years. Her disappearance, unlike the others, happened in broad daylight, though. She was last seen in the office at 2:30 p.m. that day and found to be missing at 3 p.m. Gloria's disappearance seemed to be the last straw for law enforcement. They beefed up their search efforts substantially by taking their message to the city by way of television.
We would like to ask all of the hunters, the quail hunters who will be out in the field and the pastures in this area, to be especially watchful for anything which might indicate that a body might be buried, or if they find anything that appears to be of evidence in this case. We would appreciate if they would be especially alert and call us if they do see anything. It is $1,500 for information leading to the her whereabouts. We have exhausted all the leads. We have keep getting leads from time to time, information. All of this has been checked, and we're still about where we were. No suspect at this time, though.
The public answered the call to action from police in droves, and the search was huge. This massive effort would provide no results, though. Gloria could not be found. Police didn't let up, however, and worked tirelessly to crack these cases and to find Gloria's body. Ector County Sheriff Slim Gabriel was determined to find a connection to at least one of these women and something before the madman had time to satisfy his depraved urges again. Sheriff Gabriel did find something interesting in which he kept to himself. He found that a former employee of O&L Oil Well Service, where Gloria Green worked and vanished from, had also disappeared around the same time she did. Sheriff Gabriel kept this to himself for two reasons, because he did not want to alert this individual that he was looking for him, and because, after quietly asking around about him, the man could not be found, and he didn't want to alert the public of that. Sheriff Gabriel sent bulletins to law enforcement agencies across the state asking to be on the lookout for a man named Johnny Meadows. The police continued their investigation into the cases of these young women and played the waiting game to receive information on the whereabouts of Johnny Meadows. Then, in early January of 1972, Meadows was picked up in Aztec, New Mexico, on a warrant from Gainesville, Texas, for skipping out on a bond there, and Sheriff Gabriel immediately took a trip to see him. Long story short, on Thursday, January 20th, Gabriel phoned his deputies and provided them with a location. He told them they'd find the body of Gloria Sue Nix Green there. And they did. It was on a vacant lot in an area that wasn't necessarily off the beaten path that she'd be found. It was only a mile from the city center and across the street from the practice football field of a junior high school. The nearest house was only about 200 yards away. Gloria's remains laid under an old, decaying mattress that had been disposed of on the lot next to a heap of other discarded junk, her arms and legs bound with electrical wire. She was also strangled by electrical wire, and it remained around her neck. The dress she was wearing the day she disappeared was intact, her glasses still on her face. Her ring was also found. Gloria's underwear are said to have been unremoved, thought to have been untouched. Sheriff Gabriel returned to Odessa with Meadows in tow. Meadows admitted to dozens of other murders, but only confessed in writing to a few. Most of the verbal confessions were murders that had taken place outside of Odessa. His written confessions consisted of Gloria Green, Linda Cougat, and Ruth Maynard. Also included in these confessions was a Monahans, Texas resident named Dorothy Smith, who Meadows confessed to having bound with a television cord and shot and killed with a .32 caliber pistol before robbing her. She was actually shot and killed with a .38 caliber firearm, and Meadows couldn't answer what he'd done with the jewelry. He later recanted on his confession of that murder, and of the murders of Linda Cougat and Ruth Maynard. Meadows claimed that he was coerced into confessing to all of the murders, and a court in Dallas believed him. And the confessions to the homicides of Linda Cougat and Ruth Maynard were thrown out. The murders of Linda Cougat, Dorothy Smith, and Ruth Maynard, though, are no longer being investigated. The murder of Eula Mae Miller is an open case, though that particular homicide remains on the Crime Stoppers cold case list. The arrests, convictions, and incarcerations of Johnny Meadows and Tommy Ray Neeland did little to stop the climbing murder rates in Odessa and other cities around it. It's easy, perhaps more comforting in a sense, to imagine a single individual responsible for the many appalling and cold-blooded murders that had happened and would continue to happen in the Permian Basin region of Texas. The thought of several homicidal maniacs on the loose is a frightening thought. But that's seemingly what West Texas and many other areas of the state, not to mention the nation, was facing during this period. And there'd be plenty other unsolved murders in the Permian Basin in the years to come. Many of those, too, remain unsolved today. We'll explore more next time on Gone Cold Podcast. And, spoiler alert, most are not in proximity to a full moon. If you have any information about the murders of Linda Lee Cougat, Ruth Maynard, or Eula Mae Miller, please call Odessa Crime Stoppers at 432-333-8477. The Odessa American, the Austin American Statesman, the Dallas Morning News, the Victoria Advocate, and court documents were used as sources for this episode. If you'd like to support Gone Cold Podcast, Texas True Crime, you can do so by donating at patreon.com/GoneColdPodcast, where you can hear much more about Johnny Meadows and Tommy Ray Neeland. There are several varying donation levels there to choose from, with different perks to go along with each. And there's ad-free listening at all levels. Donations help us cover the costs of research and production. And we can't thank y'all enough for your support. Thanks for listening, y'all.